Good afternoon and good evening. Depends on what time of day you're listening.
Yeah, where you are. Where are you?
Exactly. Cover them all. You are listening to We the People Radio. That part hasn't changed, really, for quite a while. How long's it been, Bob? You're the keeper of the keys. How long?
Oh,
6 years?
You started in 2010, I believe.
I think so.
That would be just over 6 years.
Six years. Mm-hmm. Isn't that amazing?
Amazing.
Go figure. Well, we were kind of tardy because we were getting some taped footage that we'll play for you probably next week or the week after. I think next week we may have Lord Christopher Monken, so we may be chatting about
climate change.
Or the lack thereof.
Or the lack, yeah.
Or the scam thereof, which will be fun for everybody. So my name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
And we all just opened cold non-adult beverages. we're sorry we deprived you of the sound of the popping. It was kind of festive. We're like, darn, we should have waited, done that for everybody. That would have been fun. So today is part two. Part two with Frank, our friend Frank Burley. It's all about Muhammad is the name of his book. And honestly, it is all about Muhammad. It's a fabulous book, a really fast read. We hope you will join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We've got the archive commercial free up from last week that links to the book and information about that. And I guess that's all about the announcements.
It's
the end of the announcements.
Quiet week, yeah. Yeah, we left off last week with Muhammad's childhood, the childhood years, the years where he preached peace and acceptance and his
when he had
religion.
No followers.
Yeah, and you know that's how you get people to join is you know everybody's included, and
so we had Frank do we asked him to do a little recap for us so we could launch forward
into the more provocative years.
Yeah, the stuff we see now.
The warring years.
What'd you come up with, Frank?
Well, first of all, thanks again. Thanks for having me back on your program.
Oh, sure. It was not hard.
Quite an opportunity last week to cover, the beginnings of Muhammad's life. Let me give you just a brief recap for people who may not have listened to the last program.
That's fantastic.
I'll be really brief. Basically, you know that Muhammad was born in Mecca. In the year 570 A.D., he was epileptic. This is a problem that was identifiable from his very early years, and it followed him throughout his entire life. When he was 40 years old, he had his famous or infamous experience in the cave where he had a tremendous hallucinatory experience that led him to believe that God talked to him. And it all started from there. He started coming out with Quran verses that he attributed to God, but which were his own compositions. These he did not write down. These were mental things. You know, these people were able to compose mentally and remember what they composed. It's extraordinary feats of memory. But he was a very in-your-face type of guy, and he really riled the Meccans. Not because he was preaching another religion, but because he denounced their religion. And so it came to the point after 12 years of putting up with him. They put up with him because they were afraid of killing him and sparking a bloodbath, a tribal war, a clan war, basically, because they were all members of the same tribe but different clans in Mecca. And it would have been like a civil war. But after 12 years, they really saw that he was subverting their way of life and decided that no matter what, they had to kill him. And he got wind of it and left. He fled. He went 200 miles north to what is now called Medina, but back then was called Yathrib.
Now, how old was he then, Frank?
He was 52 years old at that time.
Okay.
And I forgot to mention the last time. This is very important. Prior to his flight, which is called the Hijra in Islam, and they date their calendar, the beginning of time from this flight. But just before fleeing, maybe several months before, he had a meeting with a secret meeting with people who had come down from Yathrib, 75 people, to pledge loyalty to him. They were, you know, setting things up for him so that he could have a safe harbor. But they came down to Mecca disguised as pilgrims, and they held a, this was during the pilgrimage season. Every year they had pilgrimages. So, and this was held in a ravine called Aqaba, which was outside of Mecca. And during that meeting, he asked them for their loyalty, including supporting him in fighting anybody, essentially, who opposed him. And one of the men there said, you know, you really need to know what you're getting yourself into if you pledge to this man, because if you pledge to him, it will mean unending warfare. And essentially what happened on that day, it was actually at night, late at night, he declared war on mankind, war on the world. This is what happened, war on the world, against everybody and anybody who opposed him and refused to accept him as their prophet. So it really starts from that moment on.
So does he, did he really, I mean, at that point, how does he account for the previous writings that were, I mean, pretty different than what he proclaimed after the beginning of the calendar? I mean, weren't they quite a bit, didn't they have a lot different tone to them?
Well, they weren't overtly violent, but there was a substrata of violence there. It's more like just a hostile tone. He was in a weak position in Mecca. He couldn't actually become violent, although it was in his nature to be violent. But he was outnumbered, and it would have been counterproductive for him, meaning he would have lost his life. So he never pushed it beyond a certain point then. The Quran at that time in Mecca, a lot of it had to do with laying the basically the basic principles of his ideas, and also rewriting the Jewish traditions about the prophets, the legends of the prophets. His sources were not the Bible itself, but the secondary literature that evolved folk tales about the prophets. This is a giveaway that he was a total fraud. He claimed to get all his stuff from God, but it, in fact they were inspired by the Jewish legends of the prophets. And these all came out, for the most part, in Mecca. So when then he fled. They were going to kill him. I mean, they had all decided to do it and how to do it. He caught wind of it and he fled. So and he ended up in Yathrib, which is Medina, where he built a mosque. It took 7 months. It was basically his Al-Qaeda, which means base of operation. He used it as his headquarters then to begin attacking Meccan caravans. The Meccans, you know, depended upon trade in order to survive. And a big part of their trade was with Syria. They would go up to Gaza and Damascus and other areas up in that region. It wasn't called Syria back then, but that's the area. And his Muhammad's idea was to disrupt their caravan trade and also to seize their caravans in order to profit. I mean, plunder. So this led to a battle. We covered that last time, the Battle of Badr, where the Meccans sent an army of 900 men to defend one of their caravans coming back from Syria. Muhammad had gone out to chase the caravan in order to capture it, but it ended up, he confronted the Meccan army. He won, they lost. They lost most of their leadership, too. Most of their leaders were killed. He threw them down a well. And, from then on, he begins his rampage of terror in Medina and Yathrib in that valley, and then later expanding outward into all of Arabia. So it really begins there, the real violence.
Okay.
All right. So we're at a good point. The violence hasn't begun yet. Need to take a really quick break. And we have a question Peter Friedman is in a chat room firing me some notes. He said to tell you hello.
Oh, good.
Hey. He told us to ask you about abrogation in the Quran, book 2, verse 106. So perhaps when we come back from the break, we can hit that.
Oh, sure. Okay.
All righty. Okay. So you're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We're here with Frank Burley with our topic and the title of his book, It's All About Muhammad. What shall we do about them when they move into your neighborhood? They take over, but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body. Then they go. What shall we do about them? Can't touch this. Touch this. You can't touch this. You can't touch this. My music hits me so hard, makes me say, oh my Lord, thank you for blessing me with a mind to rhyme and deep hype. It feels good when you know you're down. A super dope homeboy from the Oak Town, and I'm known as such, and this is beat. You can't touch it. I told you, homeboy, you can't touch this. I guess I never listened to that before. I know, people are probably shocked out there. Oh my gosh. What will Bob find next? All right, Frank. So what's this thing called abrogation in the Quran?
Right, okay. Well, I'm glad Peter brought that up because that's very important.
Oh, he's got more.
Okay. Yeah, abrogation in the verse that he referred to. In chapter 2, I call it chapter instead of surah. Who the heck knows what surah is?
I was going to say, I don't even know what that is, so chapter works for
chapter
us.
Chapter 2 of the Quran, verse 106. Yeah, here, using his God voice, using his God voice, he authorizes himself to replace older verses with newer verses when there's contradictory information or ideas or whatever. It was just his way of covering his butt when he said things that didn't, they weren't consistent with what he said in the past. So, you know, this is one of the more humorous aspects, if you can consider this humor, of the Quran and of Muhammad, you know, where he corrects himself, but he attributes all of this, to God. So I'm sure you could find a whole bunch of, different verses that were abrogated. I have never made a list of them. I can't think of any of them.
Well, he was
at the top of my head. But
one of his notes said, he said, ask him about the historical errors with the dates that were wrong and people who married people who were over 400 years apart. So obviously they were either really, really old or they really weren't married.
Yeah.
Is there a whole lot of that?
That's another program. I'm not really up to date on that. I think Peter would know quite a bit about all of that. You know, you gave him 5 interviews already. You could do 5 more with him and still not come to the end of what he knows about all of this.
Yeah, you guys both, between the two of you, we could just have the, you used to like Muhammad Hour.
Yeah, the Muhammad Hour. Okay. Well, you know, I think it's important to just forge ahead with the biography of Muhammad.
Sure.
Absolutely.
All these other topics are extremely interesting, but they could eat up a lot of time. So, this is the period when he begins committing every crime against humanity. I mean, how can it get more awful than that? And there's a punchline to all of this, by the way. I mean, what's the point of knowing all of this about Muhammad if you're not going to do anything with it? See? And so, my idea is that the atrocity part of his career as a prophet is really a potential weapon to be used against Islam, to not only undermine it, but ultimately to destroy it. But you have to have all this ammunition in your arsenal to do that, you see. So that's why it's so important to know the details of Muhammad's life. This can all be, you know, transformed into something very, very potent, such as in movies, which I'd like to talk about towards the end of this.
Sure.
But let's get into the atrocities now, because that is what is most important to know about Muhammad, because that is what inspires Muslims today to do what they do. They follow his example. His example is called his sunnah. That's an extremely important word. It means it's just the word in Arabic for example, but it's the example of his behavior. And that includes his behavior towards people who rejected him, his atrocities. And that is where the Sunnis take their name from. The Sunnis are the followers of the ways of Muhammad, which include all of his atrocities. So it's extremely important to know that and to know what he did. So, beginning with Badr, you know, he comes back to Yathrib after his victory over the Meccans. And, you know, he's all pumped up. He begins to murder his critics. He recruits hitmen at his mosque, at his Al-Qaeda. He said, so-and-so has offended Allah and his messenger, and who will rid me of this person? So then a volunteer jumps up and he goes and does the deed. The first of his critics was an old man who composed some satirical verses about Muhammad and criticized the people of Medina for allowing him in. So he gets murdered in the middle of the night. Then a woman wrote some follow-up verses criticizing the men of Medina for being too cowardly to deal with Muhammad. So Muhammad recruits a killer at the mosque who goes and kills her in the middle of the night. He's sleeping with her children. He runs a sword through her. He goes back to the mosque, and it's 4 in the morning, you know, when they start their dawn prayers, and reports that he completed the mission. Muhammad compliments him and compliments him to the entire congregation. Then the man then says, though, but I'm really concerned I may have offended Allah by doing this. And Muhammad says to him, and this is really important, he says, don't worry about it. I mean, he didn't say it, don't worry about it, but he said, two goats won't butt their heads together over that woman. Very saintly.
Yeah, no kidding.
So anyway, and it continues, you know. There was one other poet who was murdered. Then he purged one of the tribes of one of the Jewish tribes. I mentioned this briefly last time. The tribe. He was intent on getting rid of the Jews because they rejected him. The Jews saw that he was spouting a lot of nonsense, claiming that he got it all from God. But it was clear to them that his inspiration was their own legends, the derivatory stories about their prophets. So they, you know, basically told him to take a hike. But he was a violent man. So he used a pretext to attack the first of the Jewish tribes. He attacked their fortress that surrounded it. There was a siege, lasted a couple weeks, and then they finally gave up. He wanted to murder all of them, cut their heads off. But one of their pagan allies intervened, and Muhammad let them go, but took over all of their properties and then distributed them to his followers. That was his MO, you know. So this was the beginning of it. And within a year, he had terrified so many people in that valley among the Polytheists. There were two major pagan tribes out of a population of maybe 20,000, half were Jews, and half were pagans. But he started getting a tremendous number of converts to his religion at that point. And not because they believed in him, but because they feared him. Terror works. It's a great recruiter. Instead of being, you know, terrorized by him and even murdered, you know, they went and grabbed his hand and said, the Shahada, which is the declaration of faith. There is but one God, and Muhammad is his messenger. And that's an irrevocable type of a declaration. You can't back out of it at that point without being an apostate and being murdered for it. So this was the process. And within a year of Badr, you know, a big, significant chunk of the non-Jewish Medina embraced his religion and started banging their heads on the ground and reciting his verses and so forth.
Imagine that.
But it didn't stop there. That was just the beginning. The next episode of all of this is that the Meccans wanted their revenge for what he had done to them at Bader, and they spent a year assembling a bigger army of 3,000 men. And so the year after Bader, they marched on Medina. They went north with their 3,000 men. And at first, some of Muhammad's advisors thought they should defend themselves in the city or in the villages that made up the valley. But he made the decision actually to go out and confront them out in the open. And this was up north by the mountain there called Uhud, which is at the north end of the valley. And that's where the battle took place. Now, this time the Meccans prevailed, but mainly because Muhammad's archers disobeyed his order to stay put on a hill. He didn't have enough men to actually cover this sort of like a cove. He put his men, his line across the cove, but there wasn't enough to cover one of the ends, so he put a bunch of archers up on top of a hill. And his people, he had only about, 700, 800 men against 3,000, but he still prevailed in the beginning. And they were able to punch through the Meccan lines, and a lot of them made a race for the Meccan camp because they wanted booty, right? Anyway, the archers saw that and went after these guys because they wanted their booty too. Well, what happened is that this created an opening for the Meccan cavalry, which had been previously repelled by the archers. But then they attacked and went around first up and killed the last remaining archers. There were only about 10 out of 50 left. And then they attacked Muhammad from behind. And they were slaughtering Muhammad's people. They were running helter-skelter. Muhammad had to flee to the hillside of Mount Uhud with some of his men. And he was badly wounded in this encounter. First by somebody, hurling a sling stone, and then another who got close enough to land a sword blow on his head. He's wearing a helmet, and it kind of pressed down into his skull to the point where he was bleeding badly, and the stone had pushed in his chainmail on his cheek to where the links were embedded in his skin. Mm. Anyway, they thought he was dead, and a big cheer went up, but he was actually quite alive, although bloody, and hiding on the mountainside with some of his men.
You have to give him credit because he actually did, mix it up with his guys. He wasn't one of these leaders that led from behind. He mixed it up.
Well, he led from behind, actually, because he was always behind the lines, directing the battle from behind, like a general,
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't actually a combatant in this situation. His line was overwhelmed, and, he got attacked personally because they knew who he was, and they went right for him. But he was able to get up the mountain. So the long and the short of it is that the Meccans were really stupid. They didn't follow up on their advantage. They had a kind of a strange theological debate with him at a distance with the Meccan leaders down below on the plain and him up on the mountainside, and they agreed to a rematch the following year. They should have just gone after him, and killed him then and there, but they didn't do that. Very strange. I mean, there's a good explanation for it.
Well, they were pretty bloodied at that point as well, though, weren't they?
Yeah. They lost a bunch of people, too. But they, in terms of numbers, actually, the Muhammad's people were took the greatest number of casualties. Probably 1 out of 10 of their people were killed. They let go of their advantage, and so they retreated and they went back to Mecca, although not all the way, because what happened is that a lot of the the Meccan leaders, they'll criticize their general, Abu Sufyan was his name, for making that decision and talk him into going back and, you know, wiping out Muhammad altogether. So they went back, but Muhammad had already assembled a pursuit force, and he only had 500 men. But one night when they were coming close, he had his people, every one of them, each and every one, set a fire, a bonfire. And so for as far as the eye could see, there were all these bonfires. And he, through an intermediary, was able to convince the Meccans that he had assembled a force greater than theirs. And so they left and went back to Mecca. And war is deceit is a famous quote about from Muhammad. War is deceit. And here he was practicing deceit. He did a tremendous job of, you know, spooking the Meccans, because all he had was 500 men, but it looked like he had 50,000. Mm-hmm. So they went back. But,
saved
of course, you know,
cleverness.
That didn't end the tensions. Not long after that, he got rid of another of the Jewish tribes, the Nadirs, they were called. And these were great landholders. They had very large plantations of palm groves and barley fields and so forth, and they had their fortress and a lot of different villages and whatnot. They're very prosperous because their day production was pretty high. You know, they used that, they sold their date harvest and made a lot of money off of it.
And this group was in Medina or close to Medina at the time?
No, in Medina, in the valley.
Okay.
It's a huge valley, you know. It's I don't know the exact dimensions, but it's probably 10 miles north-south, 7-8 miles east-west.
Okay.
It's bordered by mountains and lava plains on the east side and the west side.
Right. Well, let's take a quick break before we get into what happened there, because that's a story in itself as well. So we'll take a quick break.
And we'll be right back. You are listening to We the People Radio. You can find us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We are here with Frank Burley, the author of It's All About Muhammad. Be right back.
Call you up in the middle of the night, like a firefly without a light. You were there like a blowtorch burning. I was a key that could use a little turning. So tired that I couldn't even sleep. So many secrets I couldn't keep. Promised myself I wouldn't weep. But one more promise I couldn't keep. It seems no one can help me now. I'm in too deep. There's no way out. This time I have really let myself.
Wonder who wrote the book of love?
Tell me, oh, who wrote the book of love? I've got to know the answer. Was it someone from above?
Wonder who wrote the book of love?
Well, it wasn't Muhammad.
It was Muhammad.
Good one. All right, Frank, no pressure.
Okay. I hope I'm not scaring the bejeebies out of everybody.
No, I hope you are.
I hope you are, actually.
Everything that they do today is because of him. He's the cause of it all. Muhammad, great guy.
Mm-hmm.
All right, this is what he did to the Nadir Jews. Like I said, they were very prosperous. The Jews are hardworking people, really smart, and they know how to, you know, get things done. And they were very productive. Basically, he hated them because they rejected him, you know, because he was full of garbage. I mean, I would use stronger words than that, but I've got to respect your audience. But they were also wealthy. He wanted what they had. He wanted to take it over. He was a crook, among other things. And he needed to, pay off his people. If he wasn't able to give them plunder, would they follow him? Probably not. The terrorism was one thing to get him in line, but they needed to be happy, made happy. So he made them happy through booty, through plunder. Now, excuse me, I've got a bit of a cold. The prior to, just after Bader, he came out with his lengthy, not a lengthy, but a kind of an average length chapter called Booty. And it's chapter 8 of the Quran now. And in it, he tells his followers, you know, enjoy what you take in war because it is good, something like that. You know, it's God's gift to you, so enjoy it. But he also included a verse that turned out to be an extremely convenient verse for him, where he says, and I'll read it, if thou fearest treachery from any folk, then throw back to them their treaty fairly. Lo, Allah loveth not the treacherous. So he was the one who defined, you know, who is treacherous. So he got rid of the Kanukas, the previous Jewish tribe, using that kind of a pretext that they were treacherous. And now with the Nadirs, he did the same thing. What happened was that he went to their fortress, and this is over some kind of a blood money thing. It's really not clear what it was all about, but that they owed some blood money for something or other. And he and his men were standing at the gate of the Nadir fortress when suddenly he panicked and left and never came back. And his buddies, you know, his cronies, went to look for him back at the mosque, and they found him there. And he said, well, they were going to drop a millstone on my head. Therefore, they are in violation of whatever treaty we had with them, and I am authorized by God to get rid of them, by God. So he did the same thing. He formed this huge siege, you know, got all the, you know, booty was in the air, so he didn't have any trouble getting recruits. And they laid siege to the fortress. The Jews didn't give up. They were hoping that they would get some assistance from their former pagan allies who would come in, and from the last remaining Jewish tribe apart from them. But help never came. And so they negotiated with Muhammad about leaving and leaving everything to him, but as long as they left alive. And so he agreed to that. And they were able to take with them all of their possessions that they were able to load on their camels. And so, you know, he gave them 3 days, and they loaded up and left. A lot of these people of the Nadir tribe, in fact, all of them, were related to Jewish tribes, a Jewish tribe up in Kaibar, which is about 90 miles north of Yathrib, which was, Kaibar was another oasis, and it was entirely Jewish. And it was called the date farm of the Hijaz of Western Arabia. Very productive. One of the plantations there had 40,000 trees. Can you imagine? I mean, their production of dates was enormous. So most of those people of the Nadirs went there to Kaibar, where they had properties and also a fortress. So, everything in Yathrib and Medina, Muhammad seized it. Then he came up with a verse saying that, you know, the only time that booty is due to his followers is when there was actual warfare and they had to fight. But in this case, they didn't have to fight. The Jews gave up. So instead of dividing it up among his followers, his new followers from the Valley of Medina, he gave the majority of it to his Meccan followers, you know, telling everybody that that was the equitable thing to do. And that's what happened. He gave farms and plantations and whatnot to his major cronies, the guys that had come up with him from Mecca. So it was the plunder of the Jews, and the second of the three major Jewish tribes was now expelled. And, you know, that doesn't satisfy somebody like Muhammad. You know, there's all kinds of ins and outs. I mean, during all this time, he's conducting more raids. And not just on the Meccans, on their caravans, but on different, you know, pagan tribes. You know, the whole region was predominantly polytheist tribes, and he would attack them. In part, you know, to score plunder, but also to subjugate them, you know, and force them to convert. If they were polytheists and they refused to convert, he would kill them. If they were Jews or Christians, he would accept a subjugation tax from them. So that was his M.O., you know. Yeah, and he was very active. There were always these expeditions going out from his headquarters, from his al-Qaeda, to now, attack people.
Was this the time when he became a little bit upset about the Jews taking so much of their wealth with them and not leaving much behind for him and his men? Didn't that kind of upset him, and he kind of rethought that policy?
No, he never did. In that case, he was a smooth talker. I mean, this guy, he could be, you know, he could sell you sand in the Sahara. He was that good. You know, a real slick talker. So how he finessed it with his Medina followers is that when they first came to Medina, his Meccan followers, and there were more than 100, there were maybe 200 of them, if you include the women and children, they were indigent, and so he brothered them with, he paired them with people of Medina. It was new converts there. So they kind of like had the burden of helping these people out, which was, you know, a strain for a lot of them. So he told them that by this new arrangement of giving all of this booty to his Meccan followers, he was then relieving the Medinan followers of the burden, the financial burden of helping these people. So anyway, that satisfied him enough where, you know, he didn't have a rebellion on his hands. But, you know, there was other, you know, other resources. There was other money coming in from all of these raids, so they didn't have to worry too much about it. Anyway, where does he go next? Like I said, you know, there's all these raids and raids and raids, you know, it's crazy. And
well, that's how he supported his cause, though. I mean, that was basically his only means of income and growth was to acquire more and more booty.
Yeah.
To pay off the guys that were fighting, but then isn't that how he got, I mean, basically that's how he got his converts.
Yeah, a lot of them. He forced them to convert.
Sure, it wasn't like they all said, "Oh, what a great message! Let's do it."
That's what he was doing. So, anyway, there's all kinds of ins and outs of the story. It's really fascinating, but obviously too much to cover here. But the Meccans were still a big problem for him, and at one point, he went on a pilgrimage to Mecca, and this was kind of like a way of thumbing his nose at the Meccans because. The holy months were an institution going way back in Arabia, where 3 months of the year and the latter part of the year were devoted to the pilgrimage, and violence was not allowed. So he was thumbing his nose at the Meccans. He went on a pilgrimage there, you know, claiming the right to pilgrimage and the right to safe passage. However, it almost came to a battle though. When he approached Mecca. And there was a valley called Hudaybiyah near Mecca, just outside the border of the sacred territory that surrounded Mecca. It was like 10 miles in every direction. And he ended up negotiating a treaty with them where he would allow them to resume their trade with Syria in exchange for a cessation of hostilities for a period of 10 years. It was called the Treaty of Hudaybiyah. And what he accomplished by that was to neutralize the Meccan threat for as long as it was convenient for him. He was facing a new threat from the north, from Kaibar, from the Jews there, forming an alliance with pagan tribes. There was there were some major pagan tribes up in that region, and he was afraid of attack from the north. So this was his way of neutralizing the threat. He took his pilgrims, there were 1,500 of them, back to Medina, and then just, you know, laid the groundwork for an attack, but he did everything in secret. He didn't tell anybody what was going on. And then finally, the day came when he attacked Kaibar. It was like a lightning attack, where they covered a distance of 90 miles in 3 days, which is pretty good speed for, you know, a small army of 1,500 men. And they laid siege to this big valley. And it was a long serpentine valley between, the lava beds. There's a lot of lava flows there throughout that whole region. Amazing how much volcanic activity there was at one time there. And this valley was broken up into different regions and lots of fortresses. I mean, they had fortresses galore because, there was always the danger of attack from people.
Sure.
You know, from the outside. And Muhammad picked them off one at a time.
Just marched his way through. Hold that thought, Frank. We've got to take one more quick break here before the top of the hour.
All right.
It's never a good place to stop. But it seems like we have a lot of breaks, but we don't really. It just feels like we do. It's like, darn it, we're just getting to the good part. All right.
Okay.
We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. I guess if you've got booty, you can shake it, huh? Oh, my gosh. This is how we keep from going crazy, Frank.
Well, you got some selection of songs there. Are we ready to go back?
We are. We're on. We got 4 minutes here until the top of the hour, but then we have a whole hour left that, of course, will burn right through.
You know, I actually got ahead of the story because there was another major Meccan attack on Medina that happened actually before Kaibar. Should we backtrack a little bit?
Yeah, sure. We can do
whatever
we want.
Yeah, this is really important because the Meccans this time raised an army of 10,000 men and another 2,000 from the north. So they had 12,000 men. And they attacked the entire valley. But Muhammad had his spies in Mecca, and so he knew ahead of time when they left. And that gave him time to make a preparation. And he got some advice from a Persian convert named Salman. I'm on the Persian, to dig a trench, because that's what the Persians would do, a huge defensive trench. And so in the space of 6 days, they dug a trench 3 miles long and at least 6 feet deep and 10, 12 feet wide. And it was an amazing accomplishment. And it protected the valley and all his vulnerable points. So when the Meccans arrived, they were confronted by this trench. Otherwise, without the trench, you know, they would have, you know, put an end to Muhammad. There's no question about it. It would have been over. But they were stopped by the trench. I mean, it was too wide to jump over by horse, and if they tried to storm it, you know, it'd be one that their troops were in the trench, they would be slaughtered. I mean, there was just no way to do it. They had never confronted anything like that before. So after a three-week siege, they left. And this is when one of the major atrocities occurred. The last remaining Jewish tribe was the Kanukas. They had pledged neutrality at first. They didn't want, you know, they were afraid that Muhammad would do to them what he had done to the other two Jewish tribes, and so they insisted on neutrality. But during the siege, the Meccans sent envoys to them and convinced them to attack Muhammad's forces behind the lines in order to open up an area where the trench could be, where the Meccans could go across the trench without getting slaughtered. And they were, you know, going back and forth with this, but Muhammad was really Machiavellian. He was able to create doubts about the loyalties of each side. He claimed that he sent somebody who was really good at doing this. That he told the Jews that the Meccans wanted the hostages because they didn't trust the Jews, and then he told the Meccans the same thing. I mean, he was playing both sides against each other, and the Jews essentially backed out. And but this was towards the end there, towards the end of the 3 weeks when they were running out of food, some of their horses were dying. Then there was this tremendous storm. It was a gale, a hurricane that took place.
Okay, stop right there, Frank. We're going to take a break and
hold the hurricane. We've got the news.
We can't be late on this one.
Okay. We'll be right back after our own private hurricane. We're just going to call it the news. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Part two of We the People today. We are here with Frank Burley, the author of It's All About Muhammad, a biography of the world's most notorious prophet. And I don't think you can successfully decide whether it's a compatible or incompatible viewpoint until you find out about the guy who started the religion.
Right.
So that's kind of what we're about today. So
once you read this, I think you'll realize that some of the things that he did, had he done them in modern times, there would be no doubt he would be a war criminal.
Well, he is doing them in modern times, but people are pretending that that just started.
Right.
It didn't just start. It started way back in the 7th century. So, without further ado, hit it, Frank.
All right. Okay. Yeah, it all started 1,400 years ago. It's all about Muhammad. There's no way around it. And it's never going to be different. This could last another 2,000, 10,000 years and won't be any different, except I would hate to see what the world is like in the future if it continues. All right, so here we are. This is the last major battle with the Meccans. They basically left. This big windstorm started up and toppled all of their tents, and it was in the middle of the night, and it was freezing rain, and, Muhammad had succeeded in sowing mistrust between everybody, using very deceptive tactics. It was brilliant in its own way, but Machiavellian and dirty and, very political. So they left. And when they left the Kanuka Jews, the Kureza Jews, exposed, because they had, in fact, sided with the Meccans. So Muhammad then laid siege to their fortress, and it lasted for 3 weeks. Now, they finally gave up, and they asked for the same terms that were given to the Nadirs and the Kanuka Jews, but Muhammad refused. And instead, he had all the males beheaded, 900 men and boys. It could be 700, probably 700 is the accurate number, but what happened is that after they gave up, all the men were rounded up and marched across the valley to the Muhammad's territory, where his mosque was. All the women and children were enslaved, and they were taken to the same area. Then Muhammad had a trench dug in the marketplace not far from his Al-Qaeda mosque, where he beheaded all of these men and boys. If they were adolescents, they were beheaded. And some of them, they would take their clothes off because they had pubic hair. Off with their heads, So he beheaded all those people, and he presided over most of it, if not all of it.
And how many was there?
700 or 800 or 900. But probably 700 is the accurate figure. So this was a major undertaking. Two of his first cousins, Ali whom the Iranians worship, is the founder of their Shia version of Islam. And another first cousin, Zubair, according to the literature, did the beheadings. And they would take these men out, five at a time, and kneel them in front of this trench, and then cut their heads off, and then throw the torso into the pit. Now, if you do some quick math here, and you can see that it took a long time. If it took, on the average, 1 minute to kill each one of these people, if it was 900 men and boys, that would be 15 hours of beheadings.
Wow.
Probably went a little quicker than that. But it lasted until late in the night, from the afternoon until late in the night under torchlight. Imagine the horror of it. You put yourself in the situation of these people. They're being marched out five at a time, pushed to their knees, told to bend their heads forward, and then these two Mohammed goons cut their heads off.
Hmm.
It's horrific. So this is one of the major atrocities that he committed, hardly the only one, but it was one of the major ones. And it's in their own literature. And, of course, they'll rationalize it, saying that, you know, they offended God and his messenger, basically, by siding with the enemies of God, the Meccans. So they deserve their fate. Now, their fate was actually dictated probably more by Muhammad's greed and his need for booty than anything else, because he needed to pay off his people. They had just undergone this tremendous siege from the Meccans. They were exhausted, and he needed to keep them happy. So, you know, he confiscated all the property, and this property he distributed. Also, he distributed the slaves. There were about 1,000 women and children that he enslaved. He divided them into five different lots of 200 each. He kept 200, which was his share. Two of his followers from Mecca were really wealthy and were able to purchase two of the lots of 200 each. And, you know, they traded and bartered and made some good money reselling all of these slaves. The last 400, he took under armed guard north to Syria, where they were sold into slavery. And then the money was brought back and distributed. Actually, they bought horses and weapons with all that money and then brought the horses and weapons back. But then they resold the horses and the weapons in order to raise cash so they could distribute the money to all of the participants, right? That's how it worked.
Sure.
So this is one of the most sordid episodes of this holy man. Then this is when afterwards, now this is when they actually made the pilgrimage to Mecca and thumbed his nose at the Meccans. Because he realized after that defeat, you know, when they left and abandoned their siege, that they were finished. They weren't going to ever do that again. So he was on firm ground when he went down there on pilgrimage and taunted them, and then ended up with the Treaty of Hudaybiyah. So, you know, then he came back to Mecca with his men. He didn't actually get to Mecca to make the pilgrimage. I mean, part of the agreement at that time was that he would not be able to come in that year, but the next year. So, in the meantime, he went back to Mecca, then he organized this attack on Kaibar, because he felt that the real threat now was coming from the north, and he wanted to neutralize it. So he attacked Kaibar, and he took it one fortress at a time. It was difficult at first, but in one of the fortresses they found some siege weapons, catapults and battering rams, covered battering rams and stuff like that, that he used then to defeat the remaining fortresses. The Jews, the last of the valley, basically decided to give up. And these happened to be the Nadirs, the same ones that Muhammad had chased out of Medina, you know, a couple years before then, two or three years before then. And they talked Muhammad into letting them leave. But one of the Nadir leaders who had previously been in Medina, hid the tribal treasures, gold goblets, silver goblets, jewels, whatever, and Muhammad got wind of it, and he brought the Jewish leader before him and demanded to know where all of these treasures were. And the man said that they didn't have them, that they sold them all in order to raise money for their defense. And Muhammad said, well, you know, if you're lying, I'm going to have to kill you. So he found actually that these treasures were uncovered. And so he learned that the treasures had actually been buried. And the Jewish leader denied it, but then Muhammad had him tortured. He was pinned or chained to the ground. A fire was started on his chest. And he was tortured like that in order to reveal where the treasures had been buried. But he didn't reveal where they were buried. And he was taken out after being tortured and refusing to divulge anything. He was taken to one of the palm groves and beheaded. And the same fate happened to one of his brothers. And probably all of the nobles of that particular tribe were slaughtered too. Then Muhammad took the wife of that Jewish leader as his wife. He had all the women brought before him to check them out. This is what he did with the Quraiza Jews too in Medina. After the fortress of the Quraiza Jews fell and the Quraizas gave up, he had all the women paraded in front of him, and he took the prettiest one, Rehana, back then, as his wife. Well, he did the same thing here in Kaibar, where he got wind of the fact that the wife of this Jewish leader was really beautiful. So he had her brought before him. He liked her beauty, and then took her as his wife. That sounds like modern politics, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In its own way. But anyway, he added her, this Jewish captive, to his harem, which was growing by then.
Of course it was. Hang on one second, Frank, so we don't wind up with all our breaks at in the last 15 minutes.
Alrighty.
Which usually happens. Take a really quick break. We're here with Frank Burley, the author of It's All About Muhammad, a biography of the world's most notorious prophet. We're on We the People. You can find us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies. You twisted my heart till something snapped inside. I'd like to give it one more try, but my give a damn's busted. Understand me now. Sometimes I feel a little mad, but don't you know that no one alive can always be an angel? When things go wrong, I seem to be bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
We won't. We're going to tell everybody about you.
Yeah. No misunderstandings.
Yeah, no misunderstandings. All right, so what else was Muhammad up to?
Oh, what else? Well, he was very busy killing people. Yeah, anybody who resisted him, you know, watch out. So, anyway, after Kaibar, you know, he takes the Jewish wife, the wife of his victim as his wife. He ends up with 13 wives officially, but he had actually tried to add about 20 more. I don't know where he got the time to do all of this.
I was going to say, that's a lot of
both
wives.
Grand verses, mass murder people, acquire, 13 wives and attempt to get 20 more. I don't know if he ever slept. Mm-hmm. Anyway, there's a lot to this, and it's just impossible to cover it all, but just to fast forward a little bit, after making his trip to Mecca, you know, the pilgrimage that was aborted. He did go back to the following year, and he made the pilgrimage, actually entered into Mecca. The Meccans allowed him safe entry for 3 days and 3 days only. And they did the routines of, you know, of orbiting the Kaaba at that point, and doing some of the other ceremonies of the minor pilgrimage, as it's called. But he also was starting to rebrand the rites of the pilgrimage at that time. The pilgrimage dated way, way back, and the Meccan part of it started whenever it was that they found the meteorite there next to the riverbed, which was probably like 400 years before Muhammad's time. But it's a long-standing tradition of pilgrimage throughout the Levant. Even, you know, the Jews went on pilgrimages. Everybody went on pilgrimages. So he rebranded the Temple of Mecca. He already started that years earlier after he broke with the Jews. He began claiming, and he put into the Quran a lot of verses about this, where he moved the Abraham story from the Levant to Mecca, where, you know, Abraham took Ishmael, not Isaac, but Ishmael, to Mecca after Hagar and Ishmael got the boot from Abraham and Sarah. Sarah was jealous and so forth. There's a long story there. But in the Bible, of course, they remained pretty close to Jerusalem. But in Muhammad's version, he moved them down into Mecca, where they built the Kaaba. It had originally been built by Adam, but then was destroyed in the Great Flood. But Abraham and Isaac, I mean, and Ishmael, rebuilt it, okay? And so we're talking like 2,500 years before even and Muhammad, right? But in fact, we know from historical records and from the evidence of archaeology that it could not have dated, the temple could not have dated back more than 400 years. And even at the time when Muhammad was born, up until he was 35 years old, it didn't even have a roof. So it wasn't even known as the Kaaba before that, because it was just a rectangular wall without a roof. So how could it be called a cube? Cube is Kaaba. Kaaba is like a nickname, right? So anyway, this rebranding began at that point, where he moved the story to Mecca. He was a genius. You know, you got to give him credit. This guy was a fabulous creative genius, where he took all these different elements and then regurgitated them in a way and reshaped them in a way where he became the hero of the story.
Yeah, he took the facts and kind of spun them. There was just enough truth in it to spin his own story around it, and people bought into it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they were ignorant. How did they know any different?
Sure. Most of them never read. You know, it was all word of mouth. So it must be true if Muhammad
said it. The Jews had their story. He said it was false. You know, how are they going to dispute what he says? He distorts, changes everything, claims that they're making things up and that they corrupted the truth that God had given to them. You know, and so he imposed his myth about himself and these myths that he created about Abraham and Ishmael. And it didn't stop there, you know. There was a year later, you know, he conquered Mecca using another ruse where he allowed himself to invade. And this time he was the one that had 12,000 men. And they invaded. The Meccans decided not to resist. They gave up. Muhammad gave them all a month to convert or die. So, of course, they converted. Then the leadership he bought off by giving them a lot of privileges. And in subsequent battles, when he attacked the Taif region, which is to the east of Mecca, there were some major tribes there. Then, he gave the Meccans all kinds of goodies, including slave girls. So to buy them off, you know, to make it sweet for them, make it to encourage them to become good Muslims. So, this process took place over the next few years after, you know, the attack on Khaibar. So, and all this time he's reinventing this whole story about Mecca and the pilgrimage. The pilgrimage, the old pilgrimage, there used to be two pilgrimages. I don't think most people are aware of this, and probably most scholars, given, you know, the literature that I've read, they seem to be totally ignorant about this, but it's all there in the books, in the original literature. I mean, you have to read between the lines in a lot of this, but there were two separate pilgrimages. One was the sun pilgrimage, where they, you know, they worship the sun, and the pilgrimage would begin at the Mount Arafat, which is about 15 miles east of Mecca. And they would stand on the Mount of Arafat, just like they do today, and watch the sun decline. Then they would race west towards Mecca, you know, on foot or on camel. It was a couple hours away to a place called Muzdalifa, which is another mount. And then they would wait for the sun to rise, and they would break out in celebration when they saw the sun again. You know, the sun was a mystery back then. It's still a mystery. But, you know, back then they had no idea whatsoever about the nature of the sun, only that it was there, it gave warmth, and that because of the sun, things grew. So it was natural to worship the sun. And that was how, this was how they do it. They did it on their pilgrimage. And then it would end up a little bit closer to Mecca near Mina, at Mina, where they had the sacrifice of the animals. And that would mark the end of the pilgrimage and also the shaving of the head. But they also, there was a second moon worship pilgrimage, which was centered in Mecca at the temple there, the Kaaba, which later became the Kaaba. But that is, the temple was devoted to moon worship. Even though they had all quite a vast array of different idols and whatnot, and god concepts that they worshipped, central to the temple was the worship of the moon. And that included the traditional orbiting of the temple seven times by the pilgrims. They would go in, you know, counterclockwise motion. And then there were these two mounts next to it, Safa and Marwa, which were all part of the ritual too. So Muhammad, you know, was always in the process of rebranding this. This running between the two mounts, which they still do today, he attributed it to Hagar. Hagar, after Abraham dumped them in the valley and then left to fend for themselves, you know, they were running low on food and water, and Hagar was really freaking out, and she was running back and forth between the mounts looking for water so that Ishmael would not die. And then an angel interceded, I think, and hit the ground with its foot, and suddenly water sprung out of the ground. But this running between the two mounts, it had a history going back, you know, however, hundreds of years, totally unrelated, but Muhammad created this myth, this story about it. It's kind of a funny story, you know, she's running back and forth looking for water. This is why they still do that today. That's part of the ritual of the pilgrimage, based upon the myth that Muhammad created about all of this. But he also rebranded the other part, the sun worship, where the Mount Arafat ceremony part of it was where the Muslims are supposed to gather in worship, just like, and he claimed Abraham did too. But it was like in anticipation of the afterlife, prior to the Day of Judgment, they would all assemble, waiting for their judgment before God. And so that's what Arafat symbolizes now. And then the trip to Muzdalifa and all of these things, they've been all rebranded in that way to where it had an Abraham angle to it. So it's totally invented. I mean, totally, totally, totally invented, but presented as the truth. And since it's been out there for 1,400 years, people take it to be the truth, even though it's a pure invention. So this is what Muhammad created, the mythology about Abraham and his connection to Abraham. He was a descendant of Abraham, and God commissioned him to bring the truth back that everybody else had rejected. And the truth is in the Quran. The Quran is God's word. Follow it, and you've got a clear path to heaven. So, to paradise. This is what he's This is what his message was. So, you know, it's pure baloney. Once you, it's hard to see through it, though. You know, it's really hard to see through it, and you have to do a lot of studying to be able to penetrate all this nonsense. But once you see it for what it is, it really becomes clear and obvious. So that's what I try in my book. I mean, it all leads somewhere. The another important myth about himself was that he is the intercessor with God. He will be the intercessor with God for all of his believers in the afterlife, after people are, after, you know, the resurrection. These are ideas that he took from Christianity and Judaism and refashioned them. He will be there like an advisor to God, to help assist him in determining who should be rescued from hell if it happens that they were ended up in hell, or to prevent them even from going to hell. He would make recommendations to Allah. It's called the intercession. He's going to intercede for people. So this is the role that he assigned himself. It's a great myth, you know. He created this fabulous myth about himself this way, where he's going to be God's right-hand man on the Day of Judgment in determining the fate of mankind.
Imagine his surprise.
It's called grandiosity in psychological terms. Narcissistic grandiosity, whatever. It's probably a couple hundred words you could apply to that guy. But it was brilliant. I mean, you have to really give him credit. This guy was totally brilliant.
How many people who actually follow this, and I know you can't give a number, but I mean, Do you think most people know this history? Because I'm kind of assuming a lot of them don't.
I don't think so. I don't think many Muslims know anything. You know, it's... how many Christians read the Bible?
Well, I guess that's kind of what I was going for.
They're raised Christian, they're raised Catholic or whatever, and then they believe because that's what they've been taught.
Sure.
But they never go into it in any depth. They go through all the motions, the rituals, which is okay, I guess. I mean, there's good socializing function there of religion, and they, you know, participate in that, and then they learn, you know, some ethical ideas that serve them well in life. The Christians, not the Muslims.
The creepy part of this story is it's like reading Jesus in reverse.
Is what again?
It's like reading about Jesus in reverse.
Muhammad, Jesus is total light, you know. Muhammad is darkness.
It's all about get rid of your stuff, follow me, turn the other cheek. This guy's about get more stuff, chop off their heads. I mean, it's like really different messages.
Bow down to my God concept or I'm going to kill you.
That's right. And all your friends, too. And do you have anybody who's 6 or older? Because I really like them young. I mean, ew.
Yeah, he set the pattern, too. I think he was, you know, really out of line even back then. One of his early wives was a little girl, Aisha. I think people are hearing more and more about Aisha now.
I think they are, too.
She was like 6 years old when he was betrothed to her. She was the daughter of Abu Bakr, who was one of Muhammad's important followers, who later became the first caliph of Islam. And then he married her just after getting to Yathrib, right after the construction of the mosque. The girl was brought to her, and in the wording of the literature, the marriage was consummated. So, and she was 9 years old. So she was with him, you know, for the rest of his life. I think she was 18 when he died. So 9 years with him. She's a big source of information about him. About 2,200 of the stories, the anecdotes, you know, the traditions about him come from her. So she's been an important source. But she was like one of, 13 official wives. And she was really disruptive. I mean, she was just a little girl, and then all these different women started coming in and competing for Muhammad's attention, so she became really jealous and very disruptive.
Well, yeah, she was, what, first grade when she was married to him? Yikes. Okay, we need to take a quick break. I got to go, I don't know, wash my mouth out with soap or something. Ew. Muhammad, 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 what are we going to do with you? We're here with our guest, Frank Burley, discussing his book. It's all about Muhammad, and seriously, a book worth reading. It's a real page-turner. He's written it, you know, it isn't just like on this day this happened. It isn't the history you remember from school. very entertaining. Oh, you're going to love this song, too. Bob, you're a bad man. We'll be right back.
Imagine there's no heaven.
Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't.
A little destruction here and there. A little terrorism. What the heck? It's a little terror between friends, especially if you're, you know, forming a major religion.
Yeah.
You know, you got to use the available tools that actually work.
That's right. If you have young daughters, there's a place for them, too.
Exactly. Everybody fits in.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, if he had to rely on persuasion, he would not have gotten anywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, no kidding.
It just wasn't working. In Mecca, he only converted 100 or 150 at the most. And that was, arguing his case, you know, with them. He didn't really begin to accelerate and gain a lot of converts until people were afraid of him and afraid of being killed.
Oh, yeah, his reputation. When he came rolling into town, you basically had... two things. You could either run and hide, or you converted. Otherwise, you were dead.
Yeah. So, after Khaibar, and he kept pushing after the capitulation of Mecca, he kept pushing, and he ended up conquering. Conquering is the word. All of Arabia. He moved into Yemen, then east towards what are now the Arab Emirates, and then northern Arabia. And then he began penetrating the Byzantine Empire, which was the Christian Empire, and the southern part of it was controlled by Christianized Arabs. And Muhammad made one incursion there before dying. Excuse me. And then his followers took over from there, and very swiftly, they conquered what's now Syria and Iraq. Moved into Persia, and they went west into what's now Egypt and Tunisia. So it was very swift, you know, like within 25 years, they conquered huge amounts of territory and imposed their religion and subjugated people. If they didn't want to convert, they had to pay a tax. But the slaughter was really great, really great. Following Muhammad's, the idea was plunder, booty. If you die fighting for the cause, you go to heaven. You get 72 virgins. That was the magic formula, you know.
Sure, you couldn't go wrong. You were either going to be rich on this world or rich in the next. Either one, if you followed him.
Yeah. Okay. Listen, this is where I think it gets to be really important in terms of what to do about Islam. It's never going to change because it's all about Muhammad. So you either get rid of it or it will get rid of you, fundamentally. And it may take a long time for it to get rid of the United States and Western Europe, but the process is already underway. And if you don't get rid of it, it will get rid of you. But how do you get rid of something like Islam that's so seemingly entrenched? You know, it's important to know the life of Muhammad, but once you know it, what are you going to do with it? Are you just going to sit on it? Chat over the fence with your neighbor about it? I suppose that's good, but this is actually what's in my book and which is derived from the original literature of Islam, is nuclear material. This is like plutonium that needs to be shaped into bombs and then exploded. I mean, that's how powerful all this stuff is for attacking and destroying Islam. This is so grotesque what he did to people who rejected him. He committed almost every crime that's considered a crime against humanity today. And I, in fact, included, I quoted in the chapter notes of my book, the section of the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Tribunal, which defines what a crime against humanity is. And he committed just about every one of them. This is a tremendously powerful weapon that can be used against Muhammad if it's taken to a higher level than books. You know, my book is okay. It's got a lot of illustrations, but books are trickle down. Not that many people read books. But everybody watches movies.
Yeah.
Everybody watches movies. So this, if people really want to defend themselves against Islam, this is the weapon to use. The truth about Muhammad. Putting it on the big screen. Just imagine, you know, the kick in the gut that would come from people sitting there in a movie theater watching Muhammad, you know, behead all those men and boys. In the storytelling of a movie, you would get the whole context of it. And you would know some of these characters. And so there you would be with them when they're brought out to the trench and beheaded.
But what's the, Frank, what's the chances of anything like that ever happening when here we bought into the story that, you know, Benghazi was caused by a little homemade film? I mean, if a major movie company wanted to do the true life of Muhammad, my gosh,
we were talking
the
about
blowback
that,
from that would be,
that'd be huge.
Oh, it'd be unbelievable.
Yeah, it would. And all I can say about that is time to move beyond the fear that terror causes.
Right.
You know, and it's hard to do. I can't claim to be a total, you know, courageous person in this. But at least I've taken a step which I think is useful by writing this book.
Yeah, the research is done.
Yeah, there it all is, you know. Go for it, you know.
We were talking
with $100 million. You know?
Well, we were chatting last week after the program about, you know, the fact that they do this in cartoon or in, what do I want to say, animation.
Animation, right. It's starting at that level. And that gets distributed on the internet, and it's good. I mean, it's a beginning, but it's not sufficient.
No.
It has to go global.
It needs to be like a Lawrence of Arabia type of...
Yeah,
yeah,
big
and not
epic.
Only just one movie. One movie would be great. But what I say to people when I bend their ears about this is that if we were to take what it costs to build a battleship, say $3 billion, and spread that over 10 years and put that money into productions of full-length Hollywood-quality feature films, hundreds of docudramas where there are reenactments to break the subject down into its parts, and put that out there globally for global consumption over the course of 10 years in aggressive, relentless, and unapologetic exposure of the truth about Muhammad that way, globally, Islam would be on the ropes within a generation. It would be absolutely on the ropes because there are two
you can't audiences defend it.
For this. There's the non-Muslim audience. People are waking up, but still most people don't have any clue about any of this. This is a good way to wake them up. Everybody watches movies, particularly when they're controversial. Then the other audience is the Muslim audience. This is what is really amazing. Most Muslims don't know the truth about Muhammad either. They are raised with the mythologized version, and they never read, you know, the traditions or the original source material. They just buy into it because they're raised into it, and so they believe it because that's what they're told is the truth. This is a way to bust through that, and it would push all Muslims onto the ropes. They would have to justify how they could have a belief in a guy like that.
Yeah, that's the thing. When you have to defend the person you're following, oops, especially when all of the traditions and things are about him. We need to take one more really quick break, and then we'll be right back with our guest, Frank Burley, who is the author of It's All About Muhammad. It's a biography of the world's most notorious prophet. And I think you'll like it. You can find all that information on our site. It's wethepeopleradio.us.
The more you ignore me, the closer I get. You're wasting your time. The more you ignore me, the closer I get. You're wasting your time.
Crazy.
So just in case you guys thought that we were going to drop the topic and move on, we're not. and I'm sure we'll have to have Frank on again, too. I just wanted to let folks know, because we always seem to run out of time at the end, that next week, basically the topic is, are Americans ready for the Islamists? With Lyle Rapacki with the Sentinel Intelligence Services and Claire Lopez, who is with the Center for Security Policy, and she is also former CIA. I had a for training purposes only, simulated communication from Sentinel that said, started with, "Good evening, Americans. I'm from the Islamic State, and I'm here to annihilate your children. While you have preoccupied yourself with messaging your Facebook friends from the student pickup area at your local religious school, I've been surveilling my target." And it goes downhill from there.
Oh, yeah. It's frightening.
So we thought that would be a good follow-up to Frank's information, just in case you weren't sure if it was actually time for you to do something about this. So, Frank, in our waning minutes here, what would you like to leave folks with? I know there's just a ton of detail that you could never fit in.
Read the book.
Yeah.
Read the book.
There you go. Sorry.
It's really important to get familiar with the ins and outs of the subject, but then to do something with it. You know, give lectures, whatever. There's all kinds of things that could be done with it. But movies, that's the real way to go. That's the best defensive and offensive weapon there is against Islam.
You're right.
Turning all of this truth about Muhammad into film. In the end of my book, in the epilogue, I suggest a movie where he's put on trial for crimes against humanity. You know, like they did with Saddam Hussein, they had him in the docket there with his cronies in the background?
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, then this is something that could be done, too, with Muhammad. In the background, you've got his cronies. You've got, Ali, you know, the mass murderer. Zubair is another first cousin who's a mass murderer. And then Abu Bakr and Umar and Uthman and all these people that became caliphs, you know. Put him on trial and then resurrect. This is the real day of the resurrection. It's not, you know, going before God and having Muhammad intercede on your behalf. No, resurrect the bodies, resurrect his victims from their graves. Bring them out of their graves and let them testify against Muhammad, what he did to them. And that could be, you know, the launching point for, recreating what he did. You know, as they're talking, suddenly there it is on the screen, you know. So put him on trial. And humanity is the jury. Humanity will watch this. Men and women everywhere, young and old, of all races, will be the jurors. And it will end on that note. You are the jury. You make a decision about this. That's what needs to be done. That's just one way of approaching the subject. There's a lot of ways of doing a movie about that guy, but I think that's a real potent idea. If I had the money, I would do it. Anybody out there listening who's got $100 million?
Yeah, guaranteed to double your money.
Guaranteed you get to make the film in hiding.
Yeah.
If you need a little break from your friends and family.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's got to be done. And this is the best weapon. Islam is a danger, an existential danger, as George Bush used to say all the time. It's true. So what are you going to do? Get consumed by it, or are you going to fight it and get rid of it? You know, it's a real choice. Which way do you want it?
And I think we need to really pound the point that we're never going to coexist. It just doesn't mix with pretty much any other society unless you want to be subservient, to their rules, and because there's no other way. I mean, if they're true believers, you can't coexist. It's ridiculous.
No, it's impossible. But you've got a lot of them embedded in our society now that push this notion, and Obama is one of them, that it's a religion of peace, et cetera, et cetera, and it's all baloney. It's a religion of war and domination and supremacy. And it's that way because it's all about Muhammad. And it will never be any different.
Sure.
And people who say things like that, they're total liars or they're ignoramuses, and they should be exposed, and we should Alinsky all of them, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's like I think you mentioned in your book that in today's world, a moderate Muslim would be executed by the fundamentalists. I mean, they don't believe in moderation. They believe in the word of the Quran and the word of Muhammad, and there's nowhere in there that's moderate.
Yeah, well, and moderation, too. What does that mean? That's more like the quiet demographic, slow process of Islamization. That's what the moderate favors. And so, you know, moderates, there's no such a thing as moderate Islam. I mean, the president of Turkey says that all the time. It's a ruse, you know, it's just another way of pulling the wool over people's eyes. There are no innocent Muslims. Anybody who believes that God talked to Muhammad and dictated the contents of the Quran to him and that they should follow his example in all things, that's what it is to be a Muslim. And they all believe that. So there are no innocent Muslims.
No.
There are no innocent Muslims.
It's dangerous.
That should be axiomatic.
Well, I think that's a very unpopular position. However, it's very true. So like many true things, dare to be unpopular. But definitely I would encourage people to get the book and read it. Because, you know, it's funny, I think I said this last week at the beginning of the program, got into a thing with a guy who was supposedly an expert on this, and he was figuratively disemboweled within about a minute and a half.
Yeah, he had no information.
I went full Muhammad on him.
Well, Frank, we really appreciate you coming on and sharing with us.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity. Really great of you folks to hosts a program like this that would cover the subject. It's great.
See, and you thought you couldn't do 2 hours. And look, we just did 4, and there's like, I don't know, a million hours left. All right, Frank, we will chat with you again.
All right. Thanks again.
Thanks a million. We were just, we just completed the second program with Frank Burley, the author of It's All About Muhammad. Please go to the website, send your friends and family links. Robert will have those commercial-free things posted this afternoon. And see you next week, where we're going to talk some more about what it looks like on the ground. This is We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.